were dealt out there, we had all kinds of ducks and geese too, we lived off of. So, as a whole, Cordova was a real nice place to
live. Do you know anything about your mother's parents?
No, I didn't. The village where my mother was born and raised, that village died off in a 1918 flu epidemic.
Oh, wow.
So by the time I got old enough to realize what was going on, I never thought to ask her, and then by then I left home, so there wasn't much that I knew about. But at one time that was a big village too.
Did her parents die in that flu epidemic?
I never thought to ask her. I look back, I wish I could have had a tape recorder and just sat down and recorded her history.
Yeah.
But too little too late.
That'd be interesting. How about your... Go ahead.
She only had 3 years of Russian school. They had a Russian school them days there in the village. Yeah.
So that's how she went to school?
Yeah.
3 years?
Mm-hmm.
And that was from a Russian school?
Yeah. Where? Because there was... that was pretty much a Russian village then, even after they bought the... it was mixed Russian and value.
Were there a lot of pure Russians in the village?
That I don't know. That I don't know. This time I started getting old enough to know what was going on and be concerned or realize the importance of that history. It was too late because I left home, and then I got in the army, and then I got married, and I never went back home. So, 1940 was when I left home, and I only went back to visit off and on since then.
Do you know anything about your father's parents?
No, I don't. He left home at a real early age. He was born in 1870, and he just never talked much about it. Why, I don't know. He left home when he was around 14 on a sailing ship. He went home when he was 18, and then he left home and didn't know anymore whether he had relatives or not.
Can't imagine leaving your home and going to a foreign country, and especially Alaska back in those days. So, in Alaska.
Yeah, Alaska was beyond the end of the world. But you see the beauty of it now, and you know how much more beautiful it was then.
Yeah.
But now fishing, going back to fishing, it's gotten so sophisticated, and now it's so important to get the fish while it's fresh into the market, so everything is really speed up.
Were the fish back then, were they ever shipped out fresh, or was everything canned?
Yeah, it was all canned. There's no way to ship it out fresh. You know. Had no no cold storage. It was totally different world then. Like I say, even then the halibut fishermen, they came up here, it took a week to get up here in their 60, 70 foot boats. And they fished for a week or 10 days, and it was all ice, they iced then. And then they went back to Seattle that way.
Do you know who, did you ever go on one of those canneries back then?
Oh yeah.
Who were the people that usually worked there? Were they natives or Chinese or?
Well, most of them were Chinese, and then later on Filipinos. They had hired them out of Seattle, and their key people were specialists like machinists. Of course, then different mechanics. They were specialists there, that they would bring them up. People that were highly qualified for the jobs. Because a lot of times when their canning machines broke down, they had to fix them right there the best way they could.
Uh-huh.
Because in them days, there's no way to get parts. Like now, if you need a part, you could call down today and could be on a late flight tonight. Be here tomorrow, but in them days, no such a thing. And they couldn't afford breakdowns.
Well, I guess that covers a lot of ground.
I wish there was more I could remember. But a lot of it I forgot, and I just accidentally remember now and then as I look back. Like, I think of when I was a kid, we made our skis out of barrel staves.
Out of what?
Barrel staves.
Barrel staves?
Yeah. That's those parts of a barrel, you know, pieces of the wood around.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we make our skis and our sleds out of that. We take a box, a couple of blocks, and put a box in, that was our sled, and the heaps, but they were good days and many fond memories. With today's standards, we were poor, but then when I look at our lifestyle, we were rich.
Yeah, because everybody was pretty much equal.
Yeah.
And everybody had pretty much the same thing. Nobody envied anybody else.
Yeah, my dad back then used to work $5 a day, 85 cents an hour. No overtime.
And what job was that?
Different jobs around town. He's the jack of all trades. He's done some carpentry and then he's done ditch digging, anything he could get, you know, feed a family.
Was $5 a day pretty okay pay, or?
Well, yeah, you could live on it. Yeah. You know, and all the other goodies. Like I say, you bought your staples and you got your, beans and rice and coffee, canned vegetables and canned fruits. Then we cycled back in the garden.
Well,
if you want to try it now, you see. Listen to it. My name is Pete Olson. I was born and raised in Cordova. My dad was a Dane, Danish descent from Copenhagen. My mother was a native Aleut, born in a village of Nuchik on in Prince William Sound. And on the island of Hinchinbrook.
What brought your dad here from Denmark?
Well, in them days, a lot of them Scandinavians, they toured the world, and when they come up here, they liked what they saw and just settled. A lot of them, because they seen all that fish, they settled down. But all along the coast you'll find Danes, Norwegians, Swedes, and Finns.
Wow.
Just they came in the old sailing ships too around Cape Horn.
Wow. You know what year he came here?
I think it was 1906. I'm not sure. That was just about the time the Copp River Northwestern Railroad for the Kennecott Copper Mine was built. He didn't come up for that though.
Did he ever work there?
No, he never did work on the railroad. And then I don't know what year he started fishing. But he was a fisherman. He, of course, he worked around town on off season. And when I first started fishing in the gill netting, well, like gill nets and seines, they were made of cotton. They didn't last long at all. They wore that silt on the Copp River really ate up the gill nets, and you were constantly working on them and replacing the web every other year at the as long as they lasted, and oftentimes didn't last that long. In them days they used cotton cork line, and cedar floats, and then of course the lead line was made of cotton. And when all that soaked up, and then towards the middle of the year your corks got waterlogged, and they become so heavy that but that was an interesting life. In them days the population of Alaska was about 60,000 people.
Wow.
Cordova was founded, there was no town there. There was a native village in Eyak River, Eyak Lake. And about 1895, around then, there was a cannery built in Odiak Slough. Then in 1902 or 3, I guess it was, when they were going to build that railroad going up to the copper mine, they started then, and I think it started operating in 1909. It was a roughly 200 mile railroad. But getting back to fishing, your seines were cotton. We usually used Manila for cork line, and then they had what they called Spanish corks. They were come from cork trees. And at the end of the season, those things were waterlogged, and they floated only half the cork showed then, and your web soaked up water, your cork line, lead line soaked up water, and your seine become very, very heavy. And that went on for years until they finally made nylon seines. But getting back to them days, it was very interesting. The boats were usually around 30 to 34 foot, 45 foot boat was big. With the smaller boats, they'd have anywhere from a 4.5 horsepower Atlas single cylinder to maybe 12 horse two cylinder engines.
What year along is this?
Oh, that was back in the 30s.
In the 30s?
Yeah. And the bigger boats would have a bigger engine, of course. They'd be maybe 40 horsepower. And those engines, a 4.5 horse Atlas, it would probably make about 2 or 3 year engines in a car now. They're just nothing but solid chunk of iron, and they only turned up about 300 revolutions a minute.
Huh. Well, the ones on the big boats, were they gasoline or they?
Yeah, they were gasoline.
They didn't even have the diesel ones.
No, it was the diesels were starting to come out back in the 30s, but a lot of your tenders had gas engines, 50, 60 horse, and of course, and diesels in them, they were heavy duty too. They didn't have high speed engines.
You talking about the diesel engines?
Yeah, then the diesel engines come out, and then the tender started putting them in, and they were really heavy duty. Really heavy, heavy engines. For instance, a 4.5 horse Atlas gas engine, I'm guessing now weighed about 600, 700, maybe 800 pounds.
Gosh.
They were real heavy. And back in them days, too, it was quite interesting. Nobody had radios. Nobody had radios in them days, and when you're sailing, you were in a bay, you talked to the tender then, and he'd tell you he'd be back so and so time the next day, or some other tender would. So even in them days, a lot of the tenders had no radios, and whenever they came up from Seattle, the cannery never knew where they were until they got to the cannery.
Wow.
But that was a lifestyle. And
is this when you were fishing with your father?
No, that's after.
After?
Yeah. But but then in them days, it was an enjoyable life. A lot of people don't understand it because of the conveniences now. But they had their merits. There wasn't that many fishermen, and nobody had to compete with each other so much. A lot of guys would come into just stay in certain bays and plug away through the season. And then them days, if you saw a school of fish first, everybody, it was a unwritten law that those fish were yours. So then when the season opened, you could go ahead and take them, which isn't like that now.
How far in advance are you talking about seeing those fish?
Oh, like if season's going to open tomorrow, you go out the day before.
Oh.
And you go out scouting around, and you see a school of fish, and you can anchor up and watch them, and the boats come in. They see you're watching them. They left you alone. They
sure ain't like that now, though.
No.
You got the spotter planes flying overhead, and everybody's listening in on those.
But that was a way of
trying to figure out where the.
That was a way of life. And in them days, we got a nickel apiece for our pink salmon, and I don't remember what the reds were. Dog salmon or the chum, they were 6 cents a piece.
6 cents a piece?
Yeah, a penny over. And of course that was a way of life then, and you could take a family of four or five, live on $1,000. Of course, a lot of that in them days is putting up fish and putting up digging clams and putting up your berries and go out and getting your deer meat. So that way of life was, of course, a lot of times too, the cannery would back you on a winter supply of food. You'd get your beans, your sugar, rice, and all your bulk staples, and all that carried you through the winter. So it was kind of a quiet life.
Was the cannery right there in Cordova?
There was half a dozen of them in Cordova, and then you find them all over the different bays too. So they were scattered all around the state, all the way from Ketchikan clean up to Bristol Bay. Then of course, then after that came World War II, and that made a drastic change. But just before World War II, there's little boats, the 30-footers, started coming out with high-speed engines. Usually started out with four-cylinder, eight-cylinder, or six-cylinder engines. And of course, when they first come out, we all thought, those old glass, they're turning up so fast. We thought an engine that turned up 2,000 RPMs would just blow itself to pieces. And of course, everybody talked about they just wouldn't last at all. We only seen the beginning, but that was interesting. And then they started getting radios, and radios in them days were big, clumsy piece of equipment. They
was this like sometime in the 40s?
Just before the 40s, in the early 40s. They're big, and they took up so much juice. You had to have a big battery to talk on them, and slowly they started improving. And then of course everybody got radios then, and always when you're going to move, you contact the cannery or the tender and telling them you're moving on. That was interesting new lifestyle in the fishery, getting faster engines and getting radios so you could talk to one another.
Do you think it really made a big difference in the, how many fish somebody caught and how much better they were able to live?
Well, it didn't make much difference in the living, but canneries then begin to, the tenders begin, if they spot fish in it, they had a code, they would pass on to their fishermen that where they're at, and they were all went to code then, code for the bay and code for the mounted fish. So then they went to different code, and in the beginning of season you get a the cannery, give you a sheet on the code, cannery code, the tender code, and the location code. So you would always listen in. Oftentimes keep your radio on while you're fishing, listening in. And of course, in this time went by, then back in them days, you pulled all your seine in by hand, and you made 7 or 8 sets in one day, and you had a real hard day.
They say it was a war log, quartz and everything.
It was of course, when you got fish, you didn't notice it, how hard the work was, but when you pulled in an empty seine, which we called a skunk haul, when you pull them in, tempers would start flying. Another thing too, when you snag up, you got a snag on the bottom and tear your seine a lot of times, and then you lose your fish. That helped your temper a lot too.
Wow.
But those were interesting days. They were a lifestyle that's all you knew, so it'd be a lot different to go back to that now after going through this. In the gill netting, I gill netted in Cordova, Cook Inlet, and up 1 year I gillnetted in Bristol Bay on a sailboat. I wanted to get up there and gillnet every year, but it was pretty hard to get in there unless you knew somebody. Because back in them days, the days of 30s, a lot of them guys after fishing about 4 weeks of the peak season, they'd come home with $2,500 in back. Back in them days, $2,500 is like $100,000 now.
Yeah, that's right.
I remember when I was a kid, if you had about $100 worth of groceries, it would fill up a pickup. Them days, $100 would actually fill up a pickup. You just couldn't believe what the prices were them days.
Well, I'll get you 4 bags.
And like a can of milk would be around 10 cents.
Were the prices of things a lot higher, you know, in Cordova than, you know, say in Seattle and stuff that you knew of?
Well, I didn't know but in them days, prices were way down. It was just unbelievable what you would get them days for $200-$300. But then again, like I say, when you made $1,000-$1,500 back in them days, you lived pretty good then.
Yeah.
It's hard to visualize it unless you were there back in them days. Then seining progressed, of course, then they started getting these plastic floats that never soaked up water. Then their cork line was the line that floated, so it really changed the salmon fishing complete.
Fishing when they came along?
Oh yeah. In fact, going back to the older years, we used to have what we called a pew. It was a one-tang pitchfork. That's the way we pitch a fish out of the boat into the tenders, and of course the tenders are at the cannery. And then came the day when they started talking about doing away with the pew. So they came when we were only allowed to pew them in the head. And
why did they change that?
For health reasons. Those pews, they, you know, sitting on the boat there, and they get rusty. And we used to just grab the fish, pitch through the belly or anywhere.
So then you had to sit there and aim for their head.
Yeah.
On every fish.
And that only lasted a couple of years. Then they went to unloading by hand. You couldn't use the pew any longer. You had to handle them all by hand.
About when was that? In the 30s sometimes?
Oh, no. That wasn't too long ago. That's only 20 years ago, I guess. Then later on, they called for help reasons. Then you couldn't use the old wooden boat lined with wood, and they fiberglass them for cleanliness, easier to clean, and because wood would soak up the gurry. Oh, there was a big change. Then, of course, the invention of that power block come along, where you had that big block up in the rigging, and you run your seine through it to lift it up on deck. And, of course, that changed fishing completely, because where in the earlier days when you made 7-8 sets at the most, in the same amount of time you could make 15 or 20 sets.
Wow. So when about was that?
Well, that was in the
50s.
Yeah. And then, of course, as time progressed, going back to in our earlier days, we were only allowed to, our seines were only allowed to 150 fathom seine. Now you're allowed to 200 with a 50 fathom lead. And them days we were only allowed a 25 fathom lead. That's a little short 25 fathom net. It had big meshes in it, but that was to hold you off the rocks, you know. You're saying off the rocks, you know, they allowed that. But they had big mesh, so fish could go through them. then, of course, when that power block come along, that was a tremendous improvement, along with your seines being so much lighter, because seines today, they didn't soak up water like the cotton seines did, so that made a tremendous difference. And then, well, back in the late 40s, early 50s, up until then, everybody fished in the bays and made what they call round hauls. They'd find a school of fish and they'd go around them. Then later years, it started what they call hook hauling, going up against the beach and running straight out and make kind of a hook on the end of your seine. And you slowly, just real slowly, tow it around back to your skiff. And now that's about all they do now, this hook haul, because they found then, as time progressed, bigger boats and started fishing off the capes in stronger tides, which meant that heavier lead line, and of course the seines were deeper. We used to have a 150 mesh deep seine, 4-inch mesh, 150 inches deep. Now they've got 100 mesh deep was called a strip. Nowadays they fish with seines that are 4 strips deep.
Huh.
And because of tides now too, out in the capes they have to, or we would have at most have 2-pound lead on our lead line. Now they've got 4 and 5 pound of lead on their lead line, so.
Because of the deeper nets?
Mm-hmm. And of course, in the early days when I started fishing, we used a skiff. When I can let the seine go, skiff men would hold back with the skiff, get the seine to run out. And that was with oars. Then later on we progressed to 9-horse outboards, 10-horse, then later on getting up to 20-horse. And nowadays the bigger seiners, they got their jitney, we call them snag skiffs in them days. The jitney now has got bigger motors than what we had when I started fishing, much bigger motors. Now those that use outboards now will have 150, 200 horsepower outboards. And yet it's just changed so drastically. And of course then everybody started putting radar on, so where we used to travel by compass only. And going back to the old days of tenders, that's the way they did too. It was only by compass that they traveled. And of course then they got their depth finders, and then they got their radios and radars. Now what's that new global
satellite, yeah, navigation type stuff? Mm-hmm.
Now they got that and they could tell you exactly where you are.
I guess the charts are probably better now than they were back in the 30s.
Oh yes, the charts now. Oh yeah.
But do you think it was any more dangerous to fish back in those days when you didn't have the, I don't guess you went out as far as they do now because you didn't have the weather forecast and you didn't fish as hard because you had to pull in everything by hand? And
the dangers are always there regardless. But in them days, you grew up in the fishing. I don't see that it was any more dangerous. In fact, it's more dangerous now because the competition.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. You know, you got all this big, heavy machinery on the boat, and they're pushing hard to fish as much as they can fish all day and all night long.
Well, you take back then, you could buy a 30-foot boat. Of course, it had no electronics on it. You could buy a 30-foot boat for $700-$800.
Wow.
Now you try to buy a 30-foot boat.
You get an old, used one, worn out for almost 20,000.
now with the diesel engine and all that stuff on it.
Yeah. But the danger wasn't there because you weren't competing like you are now. Not only that, now so many people have so much invested now that they have to go out regardless of weather.
That's right.
And in them days, we fished in the bays. We didn't go out on the capes. So
it was probably actually more dangerous now.
It is.
With the competition and going out further. And
well, not only that, today a lot of your boat owners will take green men because they get give them a lesser share. And then when you have green people on, but even so, they talk about how dangerous fishing is today. But you, I don't know if you realize it, the lives lost weren't so much in the salmon industry. It was in the crab industry, in the dragging industry, where those big boats went out in all kinds of weather. There's where more lives were lost. Not in the salmon industry. And percentage-wise, there was a lot more salmon fishermen. But
more lost in the crab.
Yeah.
Fish.
Mm-hmm. You're fishing, it's so competitive. And in the halibut, you take I remember back years ago when the halibut fishermen, they used to come up here, take a week to come up here, then they'd take at least a week to load up, then they'd run back to Seattle. And you didn't hear of the accidents they had now. Your boats are overpowered. Some people don't have sense enough to slow down in tough weather.
But did they have that 24-hour season back then?
No. In the halibut, you would fish every day of the season. But it started changing as they got more fishermen. Like I say, the fishing was is so much more dangerous now because your overpowered boats and so many unqualified men
right.
on board the boats. That's what made it dangerous. Plus the fact that with the high price of boat, the high interest, high insurance, you have to go out there and just beat your head against the bulkhead,
yeah.
as to say to come out on it.
Well, we were talking once before about how you think that now there's more fish. Versus back in the 30s, there was less fish because of the colder winters. And
well, you had your big years then. You had your real slow years then. It's really hard for me to say, but I have noticed that. As I see it, that way back when we used to have the real cold winters and bad winters, I'd say, where you'd have a freeze, real heavy freeze, and then in the spring the sudden thaw, heavy thaw, where streams would wash out the eggs. To me, I believe that was the biggest predator, was the weather. But I noticed, in the last 20 years as it started warming up, I could see where there was more of a consistency in fish. It's the same way back when I was growing up, we were only allowed one deer a year. And we had the bad winters with a lot of winter kill. And in them days, there wasn't that many people to hunt the deer.
And there was a one deer limit back in those days?
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't even know they had limits back in those days.
Oh, yeah. Well, a lot of people back in them days when there wasn't that many people, if you went out and got a deer and you didn't say anything, uh-huh. The law, ordinarily, even if they knew, they just ignored it, as long as it wasn't wasted or as long as they weren't, nobody complained to them. Then there's, you know, it was just ignored. But since the weather's warmed up, well, even when I moved to Kodiak here, when I first got out of the Army in 46, we were allowed one deer. Then as the weather started warming up and there was more deer, to the time when we were allowed five deer. And when you had better conditions for the fish too. I believe that had a lot to do with it, but
the heavier spring melts washing eggs out of the rivers.
Yeah, I believe that had a lot to do with it. And yet even then I remember we had some good years. While that wasn't a total cause, I guess we just never knew. There were some big years even then. But
back in the 30s when you were fishing, and so you went out this summer and you caught your fish and everything, and you sold them and all that, did you have to keep up with the taxes, the federal taxes and stuff like people do now?
Well, you had your federal tax, you had your city tax, that's about all. In Alaska here, we had a $10 school tax. That's, we were in the state then. And that was about all the taxes you had.
Uh-huh. But it wasn't a big headache to keep up with it, or
no, no. We were kind of in the backwoods too anyhow. You'd be surprised how little was known of Alaska. I mean, it really shocked you that.
Well, it even surprises me that you were taxed or that you had things like one deer and limits and that sort of thing.
Well, I don't know what to say about it. It was there. Well, we had to pay tax. We were still in America.
Yeah.
Of course, we had no voice. We were a territory. But it was still a good life. People are too crazy now. It's too wild.
Well, I bet it was, because then you didn't have... much simpler life. You didn't have TVs and VCRs and stereos and
we were
all that kind of mess to go out and waste your money on.
Well, another thing too, because the steamship, they come up once a month in the winter time. We got one boat service winter and one a week in the summertime. So everybody saved parts of their old engines and any bolts, nuts and bolts, anything was saved them days. And I guess we were a lot like the farmers. They always helping one another, and if you needed a part for your boat and somebody told you I had a part, you'd come and ask me. I mean, even if we were strangers to one another, and I'd tell you where my shop was, and you look left-hand side going in or whatever location, it's there. And it wasn't, them days it wasn't, well, how much you want for it, well, in them days, everybody needed something, and it was a circle that went around. Well, maybe you didn't help me, I helped you if you didn't help me, but Joe Blow back there somewhere, I hadn't needed a part that he had. And you saved your parts, and eventually you helped somebody. And that was a lifestyle. It was just an enjoyable lifestyle.
A lot different from what it is today.
Yeah.
So, when you were in the fishing business and had your family and living in Cordova, there really weren't any what you call hard years where you really struggled to get by.
Because
it was mostly subsistence type.
Well, you always struggled to get by. You know, you had bad years and good years, and some years you ate more beans than you wanted to, or rice, in them days a lot of people put up their gardens. If you went out without, it was your fault. It wasn't steak and eggs or T-bones all the time. It was good solid meals. There was no junk food then. People fattened up on it.
I've often wondered what it would be like to live back in that time. But everybody, you know, like I guess in Cordova, everybody was just kind of equal. Everybody pretty much fished for a living.
Oh yeah.
And everybody was, as far as financially, I guess everybody was pretty much about equal.
Mm-hmm.
All this competition and the rat race you have now.
Yeah, it was, a lot of ways it was a tough life. You know, you didn't, if you come from a big family like I did, there was a lot of hand-me-downs, and you know, where my older brother got a new pair of overalls, kind of, I could fit them, they were pretty well patched up, and nobody thought anything of it though. Until we all started getting old enough to earn money, get our own clothes. But
what was the schools like back in those days when you were going to school?
Well, not like they are today. I mean, the children don't have the rights then as they do now. I mean, I think that was one of the biggest disasters. Children's rights and what they can get away with today. There was no one smoked. You didn't even smoke publicly, let alone in school in them days. If you did smoke, you went out somewhere, swiped cigarettes and went out somewhere, smoked them. And of course, them days, it was the 3 R's. And that was about it.
How many grades were there? 8 or 12?
Oh, there's in the 12. There's 12 grades, yeah.
How about in Cordova, the churches? Did y'all have Baptist and Russian Orthodox?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Were you Baptist all your life?
No. No, I grew up. My mother was Orthodox, and I grew up then, and I drifted away mainly because of the way thing's worth, and for a long time there the Orthodox Church started dying off. But there was, back in them days, there was a Catholic Church, Orthodox Church, the Presbyterian Church, and Episcopalian Church.
Wow.
Well, I guess that's another reason I kind of got away from the Orthodox Church. My mother used to send us to Sunday school at the Episcopal Church. It was, well, it wasn't more than 800 feet away from our home, and she'd send us to Sunday school every Sunday, and I guess that was one of the big reasons I left the Orthodox Church. Of course, they had no priests, and many of those churches had no priests, so it died off pretty much. But Cordova was a modern town then. They had a real nice theater, real nice one. And the peak, when Cordova peaked out,